Quote, an oath is a solemn affirmation that is an appeal to God for the truth of that which is affirmed and an imprecation of God's vengeance on oath breakers, end quote. That is a statement that comes from semi-retired Judge Darrell White of the American Judicial Alliance. He's also the founder of the Retired Judges of America. And we're going to talk right now about oaths and their significance, including how they are a reminder of our Judeo-Christian roots as a nation. I'm Jerry Newcomb. This is Vocal Point. And Judge Darrell White, it's great to have you back on the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's wonderful to be with you again, Jerry. And that definition you just quoted comes out of a dictionary, as I believe, the 1828 dictionary, the very first dictionary published in America.
By Noah Webster, which he worked on for years. And by the way, many of those definitions, at least about a third of them, actually have Bible definitions, or I'm sorry, they have Bible quotations as examples of how this is how this word is used. This is how that word is used in the Bible.
Correct.
All right. Well, and, yeah, since we're talking about the Bible, let's get right to where Jesus says, don't swear by heaven, just let your yes be yes and your no, no. I know Roger Williams, the founder of Rhode Island, didn't like oaths because he felt like it was a violation of Jesus' teaching. What are your thoughts on that? And then we'll get right into the issue of oaths in general in the courts.
Well, others of our founders, George Washington in particular, added So Help Me God and brought a Bible in and I believe raised his hand as he took the oath. And that, based on other scriptures, that say we are to take oaths in his name. And so there are different doctrines on the issue of oaths, but the oath, according to Blackstone, who was one of the two, the second most often quoted person in the founding era, he says the oath, he wrote, the oath is a belief in a future state of rewards and punishment. The entertaining of just ideas of the human, of the main attributes of a supreme being, and a firm persuasion that God superintends and finally will compensate every action in human life. So it's invocation or imprecation of God's vengeance upon oath breakers that is the rationale behind the oath. And so, for example, the code of evidence that judges use, and I am still active in sitting in court. I sat actually this morning. It requires that before testifying, every witness must declare that the witness will testify truthfully by oath or affirmation, and here's what it says, administered in such a form as is calculated to awaken the witness's conscience and impress upon the witness's mind the duty to tell the truth. That's Article 603 of the Louisiana Code of Evidence, which is based on the federal rules of evidence. This concept of awakening consciences actually comes from, I believe, the Westminster Larger Catechism, question and answer number 96, which asks this question, of what particular use is the moral law to unregenerate men, and answers it thusly. The moral law is of unregenerate men to awaken their consciences to flee from the wrath to come and to drive them to Christ, or upon their continuance in the estate and ways of sin, to leave them inexcusable and under the curse thereof. That's as powerful an injunction as you can get, and that is, I believe, the antecedent of awakening consciences, which appear in the oath statutes of most of the states.
I know that George Washington said something about oaths in his farewell address, and it was very significant. Do you want to comment on that? And first of all, tell us what it is.
Well, he put it this way. He put it in a rhetorical question. Where is the security for property, for liberty, for life, if the sense of religious obligation should desert, that is, should leave the oaths, which are the instrument of investigation in our courts of justice? That's how Washington put it.
Yeah, and in the context here, he said, of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. And he went on, and this is a paraphrase, if you claim to be a patriot, but you subvert those two great pillars of human happiness, that is religion and morality, and that was said, by the way, in an age in which religion basically meant Christianity in one form or another, then you really shouldn't call yourself a patriot if you would in any way subvert those. And he goes on to say, essentially, that if we do abandon religion and abandon morality, then oaths are just words, but they have no power to them. And that's a very intriguing point he was making.
Well, as to the have no power behind them, it's still a felony offense to commit perjury or false swearing. And so it is a very significant thing. And there are times when I remind litigants in court that they are indeed under oath and that false swearing is a felony. Today, I had one litigant who came to the bench, and I think she was just probably nervous. I said, raise your right hand. She raised her left hand. And there's no requirement in the statute that a person raise their right hand or their left hand. Again, it has to do with the context of oaths being administered in a manner calculated to awaken consciences. That is in the statute. Conscience means with knowledge. But she raised her left hand. Well, as best I can tell, Gary, the source for raising your right hand is in Daniel 12, verse 7, and possibly Revelation chapter 10, verses 5 and 6, which do speak of, in some versions, raising the right hand. And the angel who I had seen standing on the sea and on the land raised his right hand to heaven, and he swore by him who lives forever. And so that's customary, is to raise your right hand.
In the Western legal tradition, what do you know about oaths and the history of oaths, and how does it in any way point back to our Judeo-Christian roots?
Well, it was absolutely indispensable to legal affairs in the sense that there is at least one older Louisiana case that says failure to administer an oath renders a nullity to testimony that may be given after that. And so it's integral, the notion of sworn testimony as being the best guarantee of truthfulness is integral to the system of justice. And we're living in an age where that's being challenged, but hey, there are evidences that it's still extant to this day. You may remember when Chief Justice Roberts administered the presidential oath to Barack Obama in his very first installation, they botched it. And it's open to question whether or not it was, well, whose instance the misstep was made, but it was significant enough because the presidential oath is mentioned in the Constitution. It was significant enough that Barack Obama summoned the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court to the White House the following day to administer verbatim that oath.
It is interesting. How come sometimes oaths are taken with a Bible, a hand on the Bible, and then other times they are not? For example, I've recently rediscovered old reruns of Perry Mason, and all of that's based in California. And I've noticed, even though that was in the late 50s and early 60s, they would all say, "So help me God," but they wouldn't, they didn't swear on a Bible. Or I don't remember if they say, "So help me God." But I know that they didn't have a Bible, which I thought was weird, because I've seen in other situations, even in, let's say, New York State, where a Bible is being administered. Maybe it's not today. I don't know. Comment on this.
There's no requirement in the statute, even as there's no requirement for raising your right hand. The requirement is to awaken the conscience so that the witness is impressed with the duty to tell the truth. And there are courts, one in particular that I'm aware of, that requested one of these Harlan Bibles that we give to courts. He wanted one in his very court room so that it's on the podium, and he does insist that witnesses place their hand on the Bible as they take the oath. But it's again, it's a matter of option. Now, I'll tell you where it's not a matter of option. It's not a matter of option in the federal judge's judicial oath, which goes all the way back to 1789, the Judiciary Act of 1789, and it prescribes the specific language for the oath of every federal judge that has ever served, current and past, on the federal bench. And it says this: I, Jerry Newcomb, do solemnly swear or affirm that I will administer justice without respect to persons. Now, that's a biblical standard right there, eight times in the Bible, four Old Testament references and four New Testament references as a standard for judging. I will administer justice without respect to persons and do equal right to the poor and the rich, arguably another biblical standard for judging. And I will faithfully and impartially discharge and perform all the duties incumbent upon me. So help me God. The so help me God is absolutely indispensable. If a federal judge fails to utter those words, he or she has not been properly installed.
Okay, but what about those who don't believe in God? In fact, wasn't there even a Supreme Court decision in the early 60s, Tecumseh v. Watkins, where they basically said, oh, this justice of the peace that's an atheist, he can still administer oaths, something to that effect.
Well, you're absolutely right, and it points out the irony that judges on the Supreme Court of the United States, one of whom was Harlan's grandson, in a unanimous case called Torcaso, T-O-R-C-A-S-O versus Watkins, 1961, they upheld Roy Torcaso's wish to be a notary public to administer oaths in the state of Maryland without taking a constitutionally required God-honoring oath himself. That was in the Maryland Constitution and has been there and still is there to this day. And he declined to do that, and a unanimous Supreme Court in 1961, that's when we were embarking on a path away from our godly heritage, said he didn't have to, so he could administer oaths. And interestingly, Justice John Marshall Harlan II, a grandson of the donor of the Harlan Bible that every justice since 1906 has signed, he participated in that decision. And that reminds one of the very sad story in history dealing with Samuel and his sons. First chapter of Samuel, chapter 7, or the book of 1 Samuel 7, says, "And Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life, and he went from year to year in circuit." That's where we get the term circuit court. He went from year to year in circuit to Bethel and Mizpah and Gilgal and judged Israel in all those places. 1 Samuel chapter 8 starts off and says, "And when Samuel was old, he made his sons judges in Israel. The name of the firstborn was Joel, and the name of the second was Abiah, and they were judges in Beersheba." And then it goes on to say, "And they walked not in his ways, but they turned aside after lucre, L-U-C-R-E, money, took bribes and perverted judgment," period. The very next sentence says, "And the elders of Israel came to Samuel at Ramah and said, 'You are old now, and your sons walk not in your ways. So give us a king to rule us like all the other nations.'"
We're basically out of time, but this is an excellent reminder about how important these things are and how important truth is in a court of law, which is very interesting. In fact, maybe we should have another discussion someday because we live in a time where truth is relative. So think many in our society today. Well, how does that work as far as oaths? Judge Darrell White, semi-retired. His website is ajatoday.com. Judge White, thanks so much for being with us. All the best.
God bless.